happy to be here. And as you might notice from my list here, I'm a person who wears many hats. But one hat I'm particularly happy to wear is, of course, as an associate of the Hero Center for Practical Ethics. And it's actually thanks to the center I'm here in Oxford, because I came here in the Enhance project, which was a big EU project where we looked at various forms of enhancement of humans. And Oxford was dealing with cognitive enhancement, and me being a lapsed computational neuroscientist interested in how could we actually hack our brains to make them function better, and what would the ethical and social impact of that be. Well, I came here and I fell in love with the city, and I've been here ever since. So I'm very thankful for that. So how did I come into this? Well, I'm interested in the fact that something as simple as a pill containing certain simple molecules can actually affect our information processing. So although I'm a computer scientist, I of course tend to think of human brains as information processing systems. And it's not obvious that something as simple as a pill could actually improve performance. If I were to just increase the voltage, for example, of this laptop computer, it would certainly not be running faster or more efficiently. But there are, of course, certain properties of the brain that actually enable it to function better when you change some of the balances inside it. And this, in turn, has a lot of interesting implication, because cognition underlies a lot of our most important activities. We need cognition in order to make moral behavior. We certainly need various forms of cognition, of course, in order to enjoy life and so on. And from that, of course, stems another importance for our societies. The cognition we individually have actually does add up, one way or another, in a rather complex manner, to the collective cognition a society does. So I've been active in the area of cognition enhancement, and quite a lot of the bioethical debate about cognition enhancement tend to focus on pills. Because, of course, people get nervous when you talk about taking an enhancement pill, especially if it might be dangerous or addictive. And in general, of course, if it's anything that has to do with modifying genes or implanting interfaces into the body or anything that modifies the body, people immediately recognize that there might be an ethical issue. However, cognition enhancement involves a lot of other possibilities. Our brains are biological systems, which means that their function can be affected by many factors. For example, clean drinking water has a cognitive enhancing effect, both by avoiding, of course, lead and other heavy metals which might impair our functioning, but also by promoting health. Exercise promotes cognitive function, again through a rather indirect chemical pathway. Then we have education. And it's according to at least a few studies, 1 year of basic education gives you 2.7 IQ points. It levels off eventually, unfortunately, but still, we get quite a lot of results here. And the interesting part is education is a very expensive form of cognitive enhancement that takes a lot of time, yet most societies regard it as so important that it's not only paid for by taxpayer money, but it's even mandatory. And now we're seeing various other interesting methods of modifying our brains. For example, genetic modification. I already mentioned the drugs. And we're also seeing interesting possibilities by using collective intelligence. Now, the thing that is going on here is that if we say that cognitive enhancement is improving some faculty, like memory, then it's obviously not just that we have to look at pills. We can improve memory by learning memory techniques. Or we can actually write things down on pieces of paper. And one interesting question is there any ethical difference between them? And of course, in terms of danger, it might be much more dangerous for me to take a pill than write something down on a piece of paper, because I'm unlikely to kill myself from a paper cut, but people certainly do and they get bad drug reactions. But it turns out that a lot of the criticisms in the debate about whether we should be using cognitive enhancers or whether there are some limitations on their appropriate use are actually technology independent. If one sums up the debate and then removes the things that are actually dependent on a particular method, like taking a pill or doing genetic modification, one still gets a pretty long list of concerns which are essentially technology independent. If, for example, if you look up Francis Fukuyama's classic Our Post-Human Future, a lot of the complaints he got with various attempts of enhancing the human condition seems to be completely technology independent. which would seem that actually they might apply to computer games and Wikipedia just as well as taking modern Adderall. So there are, for example, in America, of course, the big question is usually, is this against God's will? Here in Europe, it's about justice and equal access. Could this lead to a compounding effect where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer because we can't afford to enhance themselves? There are issues about cheating. Are students who take enhancers really cheating in compared to others? And then there are issues about the psychological effects, the social aspects of, do we freely choose these forms of modifications, as well as issues of the overall effect on society. And of course, one can think about the safety and efficacy effects too. Schooling probably has a lot of effects on our brains, even on a purely biological level. And to my knowledge, nobody has ever really studied it. It turns out that if you do a brain scan of a brain, brains that have learned how to read or not, you can see differences in the language systems. Because once you learn to read, once you crack the phonetic code, nonsense words actually are no longer objects, but they are strings of phonemes. We actually change our perception of the world through our education, and it's impossible to unlearn this. Now, I doubt it's a very serious danger that we learn how to read and write, but it's interesting that we have been taken for granted that it is safe and there are no untoward effects of having a lot of education. Similarly, we have other issues about personal identity and so on and so on. The interesting thing about these ones is once we start looking at enhancements that are not biomedical, it might be that they work in very different ways. So in general, of course, we spread around a lot of our cognition in our environment. Right now, I'm using my own gestures as an aid for my working memory. I'm having various gadgets around me. I'm having notes on a paper. And if you were in my office, you would notice that most of my mind lies strewn out across my desk, of course. So we embody our cognition to a large degree. We're actually making use of our extended phenotype. Conversely, of course, we also extend our cognition. So David Chalmers originated this idea about that, well, we could be having parts of our minds outside our body. So you probably have heard about his famous example of Otto's diary. Otto has a very bad memory, but he's got a diary where he notes down everything. So when he needs to find his way to a particular destination, he looks it up in his diary. And Chalmers makes the argument that, this diary functions just as we would say a part of Otto's memory does, we should actually regard it as properly a part of Otto's mind. I encountered a very interesting situation that made me realize that I certainly have parts of my mind strewn out on the internet. When I was at a bioethics conference in Beijing a few years ago, I discovered that I couldn't reach Wikipedia because it was censored. And, well, normally I would not have noticed this, except that now I got an error message. I couldn't reach Wikipedia. Suddenly I became conscious how much I subconsciously, unconsciously accessed that particular web page in order to look up different things. I was doing a fairly complicated operation involving a lot of clicking and writing on a keyboard without being consciously aware that I was actually gathering information that way. And this is, of course, true for a lot of our everyday extended cognition activities. The gestures we do, very few people actually regard them as memory aids. And it seems that we're actually having a lot of interesting tools to extend our cognition. So we're getting more and more networked. And of course, having a networked form of cognition, especially when you have accessible external objects which can be shared between people, also implies that you can start seeing overlapping cognition. Wikipedia is not just part of my kind of extended memory, it's also part of a lot of other internet addicts' extended memories. Of course, we can try to interface our brain directly. We can put on EEG caps or in some cases even implant things. But this has a relatively low bandwidth. To learn how to read and write using this kind of EEG control system is a very cumbersome process most people do not have much interest in doing. Maybe in the future we could be able to accelerate this, but it's pretty unlikely that we're going to get there very soon. On the other hand, using computers in the everyday fashion can become an unconscious process, and it seems that some of the external information sources actually do have quite an influence on our thinking. And of course, we can wear in different forms of information. So to the right is a younger and slightly nerdier version of me with my wearable computer. This was somewhere in the mid-90s. I kind of demonstrated that I could make a computer I could carry around. These days, of course, it's completely pointless because I already got a smartphone. And the smartphone is doing so far more than I could ever do with that. Of course, in the Middle Ages, similarly, we had other forms of extended cognition. For example, in the Ars Memoriam, particular methods of learning how to memorize large amounts of information and categorize them in useful ways. The interesting thing is these form kind of exocells, an aspect of ourselves that we artificially created that serves certain of our cognitive functions. Similarly, we have a kind of impersonal exocells, so collective exocells like Wikipedia and many online systems. So I would argue that if extended mind hypothesis has any validity, I would regard parts of Wikipedia as actually part of my extended mind, and probably part of extended mind of many of you. Similarly, there might be ways of doing collective enhancement. So I think one of the benefits of being a bit late is that I could update, so I could actually quote Julian Assange here. So he mentions something interesting in an early unfinished essay, where he essentially points out that a conspiracy, that's actually a form of cognitive enhancement. The purpose of a conspiracy is to make allow the conspirators to do something they could not individually do. And this is, of course, true not just for an evil conspiracy, but for any group of people who just collaborate on any work. It doesn't have to be secret. It's just that the conspiracy is a particular kind of group that gets a benefit out of being secret to other groups. Conversely, of course, his point that it takes an input, information from the environment, tries to do an internal processing, and then some action. Essentially, that's supposed to be a mind-like activity. It's done, of course, by a lot of individual minds within the conspiracy. But the results can actually be quite different from the intended ones. So in general, of course, we know that bureaucracy, quite often the individual bureaucrats actually want to achieve good ends. But we're also following rules, again, written by people who have decided they want to achieve good ends. But the outcome can be very negative. And one of the reasons is, of course, that the network, the information process that emerges from their interactions, even when they're carefully scripted in the forms of laws and regulation, quite often do not produce the right form of cognition. Another interesting example is, of course, juries. So we have a jury system of the United States and the UK. And basically, on paper, it seems that the jury is supposed to subserve a cognitive function. We're supposed to listen to the evidence in a court case, and then they're going to remember it, go into deliberation, discuss with each other what the evidence says, and then based on that reach a verdict which is unbiased and is going to determine whether the accused person is found guilty or not. The problem here is, of course, that jury deliberation is actually a process that's not necessarily unbiased. Various studies, of course, on group psychology and cognitive psychology have found that when a group deliberates about a question where the answer is not clear, where it's not easy to recognize that they reach the right conclusion, they actually do tend to be biased by members, especially if particular members hold a particular view that they're not going to shift, even when the others disagree. In the long run, the members who simply refuse to change their opinions are going to win over the others. Some of you might have seen the classic movie 12 Angry Men, which is a story about one member of a jury who is the lone voice that recognizes that the accused person is innocent. And because he knows that and he doesn't change his mind, he gets everybody else on the right side. However, it could just as well have been the opposite situation. There is no guarantee just by having deliberation that you reach the right conclusion. I worked on a little paper with Julian about whether we could give cognitive enhancers to juries. And it certainly seems useful if we could give them a pill that improved their memory, because we have to remember a lot of information from a court case, quite often very complicated information. But that would probably not have much of an effect on the outcome. Because although the jury members might now, in deliberations, remember the right things, they're not going to be able to make use of it due to the biases inherent in the deliberation process. On the other hand, we can set up other kinds of systems. So one interesting example is what I call super knowledge. Just as we can imagine superintelligence, a form of intelligence that is much larger than a human intelligence, we can also imagine ways of organizing knowledge in such a way that the total amount of knowledge is much larger than any individual mind could handle. So as we do in the lower end of this slide, where I have some example for a very interesting project called 80 million tiny pictures. So it took all the concrete nouns in the English language and did a Google search for images for them and gathered 80 million pictures of everything, everything from doctors to trees to bottles to bathrooms. And this database that fills an entire hard drive is able to recognize images taken by a camera at about the equal ability to a human. This is quite impressive from an artificial intelligence and image recognition standpoint. The interesting thing is this system does not do is using any kind of intelligence. It just compares the picture with the 1,000 pictures in the database that look the most like it. And then they get combined together into a probable estimate what it is. So you show it a picture and it can estimate that, well, that looks like a scientist, or at least a person, and definitely an organism, and it's a living thing. So you get semantic information out of having a lot of data on the internet, of course. Real humans, having real minds and understanding what we do, produced a lot of that information. But by gathering together in a clever way, we can get a very effective system that actually achieves an amazingly good performance. The next step is, of course, that it's easy to package. And thanks to that, we have systems like Google that actually reaches an amazing performance compared to many of our abilities. Again, by conveniently packaging it. And again, I don't know how many times I search on Google every day, because I don't notice it. It's actually gone below my conscious threshold. So it seems that we actually have developed quite extended exoselves. And from an ethical standpoint, there are many interesting issues. So the justice and equal access issue still remains, but it also becomes slightly more complicated because now it's not just access to the technology itself, but also to the ability to make use of the technology. The issue of cheating, of course, comes up in school, where far too many students just download something from the internet. But there might be also interesting questions. If I write an article and I make heavy use of Wikipedia, am I cheating? Well, first of all, I should, of course, be using better sources. But it's also that there is so much pre-packaged information out there. So I might actually make something that is on the surface quite coherent, although I haven't been doing thinking. The thinking was done by somewhere out there, or actually a collective of people. So it might be, of course, that we get too used to that. But there's also the interesting issue that do we have a free choice in using this? Well, I'm still not on Facebook. But sooner or later, I'm probably going to get forced to it because it's simply everybody else is on Facebook and I'm making use of a system and the social penalties are getting higher. So we're having exactly the same problem here. Similarly, we have perhaps an obligation sometimes to make use of systems. If I don't look up something on the internet before pestering my colleagues with a question, maybe I'm actually wasting their time. Maybe that is actually not a good thing to do. The interesting part is also the cognitive biases we get in a collective system. Who is responsible for them? There is certainly no neutrality anywhere, but the cognitive bias we get from putting part of our reasoning online or out in external systems. Am I responsible for making sure I'm unbiased when using the internet, or do we have a collective responsibility? Similarly, of course, we have a general discussion about the benefits and drawbacks for society. I also think a particularly interesting issue here that came up this morning is, of course, the autonomy issue. Because it seems that we're actually getting a form of distributed autonomy. Who is responsible for what is written on Wikipedia? Most Wikipedia articles these days are a result of many people working together. If you actually label the different parts of the article by the authors, most of them are going to be a very colorful map. You're going to see that even a single sentence usually has two or three authors. So who's responsible for writing that? Well, it seems that if one uses the extended mind hypothesis, we should actually say, well, it's a collective. So who's responsible if that article is biased? Well, that might indeed also be put on the collective. Now, coming back to the first talk today, to Western philosophy, this is of course a problem, because persons are supposed to have autonomy. Collective autonomy, that's not really clear here. But I think it might be an interesting case to argue that we could perhaps use fuzzy logic and actually argue that we could have a distributed autonomy in a kind of fuzzy sense. In the same way that in fuzzy logic we acknowledge that membership of a set, it's not necessarily a binary situation where you're either in a set or not in a set, but you can actually use diffuse relations. We can actually argue that, yeah, we can also have distributed autonomy. To some extent, I'm responsible for what I'm doing, but there is a certain amount, part of my actions, which are actually due to my exoself and the people whose exoselves are overlapping with me. I'm not certain whether the formalism of fuzzy logic actually produces any useful insights in this area. I've been trying to kind of see whether it produces it. It might be that one can just turn it into Bayesian statistics and be done with it. But I think there is something interesting going on there, that we're actually seeing more and more complex forms of shared responsibilities. The real problem with using fuzzy logic might be that it's actually too sterile. We need a much more rich and more sociological way of looking at the kinds of autonomy we get when we extend our exoselves. In general, of course, combining a lot of subunits does not necessarily produce a coherent outcome, and it does not necessarily produce the same outcome that we would like to have. So one of the interesting realizations I've seen when I've been looking at this technology is that generally the virtues of a technology tends to be also be its vices. Thanks to that, email allows anybody to communicate with anybody else very cheaply. We get a lot of spam. And thanks, of course, to collective enhancement, we are going to see a lot more of the kind of collective groups that Assange were talking about. A lot more people are going to be trying their hand at making their own conspiracies or groupthink. We're going to see a lot more interesting empowerment of small groups that are going to have bigger impacts on our society. So we might, rather than seeing the big hand, the very unified one, we might actually get a noisier society, because there's so many forces that get amplified that they affect our reality. Well, thank you. I hope this has been useful to kind of bring a bit of the fuzziness inside our skulls out into the environment outside our skulls.